There is this thing. Do you realize what is? There is this thing. Do you realize
consciousness is affected?
There is this thing
on.
There is this thing going on.
Do you realize our consciousness is affected?
There is this thing going on.
What is called
the news? I'm brought to you live.
Welcome to the Friday edition of CKUT's Community News Program, Off the Hour. Today is April 2nd. My name is Brian Jefferson.
And I'm Sarah Jesmer, and we will be your hosts today.
CKUT broadcasts to you from the unceded traditional territory of the Anishinaabeg and the Kanyekahaga, one of the founding nations of the Haudenosaunee Confederacy. Stay tuned, we'll be right back.
Radio. Sound waves in the air.
CKUT.
Montreal, Canada.
CKUT.
First, some news. Quebec has seen an increase of approximately 1,000 COVID cases of the highly infectious variant each day over the last week. 65 years and older in Montreal are also eligible for vaccinations, and the premier says he expects to expand age groups by mid-April. There have been 3,394 confirmed variant cases in Montreal so far, and there are no changes to current health restrictions. Frontline workers and members of the Defund Police Coalition met Sunday in Peace Park. They set up a papier-mâché pig in the square to collect sticky notes about what people want to see more public funds be reinvested into.
Amy Edwards is Kanyekahaga from the Six Nations of the Grand River community.
The idea came from a previous demonstration we did, and we just had this idea to build a giant piggy bank. Obviously, it's metaphoric for different reasons.
And Jessica Keano is a member of the Defund the Police Coalition. She also runs the Iskwayu Project through the Native Women's Shelter. One of Iskwayu's goals is to help families of missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls work with the city police. She says the cooperation between community and police is not working, even though there's an official agreement in place. And there needs to be other avenues of help.
I do interventions in domestic violence, and all I can say is that when we talk about defunding the police, it's about ending violence against women, against trans people, against sex workers, against marginalized communities. It's about investing in actual services to end cycles of violence. Like right now, the only thing that we can come up with is put people in prison and continue traumatizing them over and over again.
The coalition is calling for the SPVM budget to be decreased by 50%. And the coalition said they're looking for a mayoral candidate to take a stance on defund the police movement. Former Mayor Denny Coderre announced this week that he will seek municipal re-election in the fall. He's head of the Ensemble Montreal party and has a platform based on compromise regarding social issues. And provincial officials and community organizations gathered in Parc Lafontaine this afternoon to raise awareness about violence against women in Quebec.
Vivian Michel is the president of the organization Quebec Native Women. She spoke to the hundreds that gathered in Lafontaine Park about how all forms of violence against women must stop, like economic violence, psychological violence, and physical violence.
La violence psychologique est encore plus terrible. La violence physique, la violence sexuelle. Et de la violence économique, les cinq formes de violence qui sont inacceptables. On a besoin que nos femmes soient en sécurité. On a besoin que nos femmes soient protégées.
The March of Montreal took place at the same time as the gatherings in Gaspé. And Solidarity Across Borders announced last weekend that organization members and migrants will be walking from Montreal to Ottawa this summer. They hope the seven-day-long action will encourage naturalization for all documented and undocumented immigrants. The march will be set for mid-July. And lastly, CKUT's annual funding drive ended this past weekend. The station exceeded our goal, so thank you.
And thank you.
V.
Vaccination against COVID-19 is now underway for priority groups. Visit quebec.ca/COVID-vaccine to follow the vaccination sequence planned for your area and book your appointment online. If necessary, you can also call 1-877-644-4545. Once you've been vaccinated, it's important to continue to protect yourself by following the basic health guidelines. The vaccine, a safe way to protect ourselves. A message from the gouvernement du Québec.
Welcome back to CKUT's Friday Off the Hour. The time is just after 5 p.m. CKUT has been operating remotely for over a year now, and the pandemic has changed programming. Shows will be a mix of pre-recorded segments and other relevant audio. We're going to tune into a podcast today and revisit the 2016 Dakota Access Pipeline protests. The final straw radio talks to one person who's still fighting charges associated with the Standing Rock in court. We'll bring you back at the top of the hour with some of the news that you can use.
Airing first on Asheville FM, WSFM LP 103.3 in Asheville, North Carolina, this is The Final Straw, a weekly anarchist and anti-authoritarian broadcast and podcast emanating out of occupied Chalagi land in southern Appalachia. We bring you voices from struggles for liberation from all around the world.
It's been nearly half a decade since thousands of indigenous water and land defenders and their accomplices and allies weathered a difficult winter and attacks by law enforcement and private security, attempting to push the Dakota Access Pipeline through so-called North Dakota. The DAPL was eventually built and has already, unsurprisingly, damaged the lands, waters, and sacred sites of the Standing Rock Sioux and other people native to the area. Resistance has also continued to this and other extractions and pipeline projects across Turtle Island, and the defense against DAPL surely inspired and fed many other points of opposition in defense of the earth and native sovereignty. On one night in November 2016, as government goons leveled fire hoses and, quote, less lethal, unquote, armaments at water defenders in freezing temperatures, Sophia Wolanski suffered an injury from an explosion that nearly took off her arm. Steve Martinez volunteered to drive Sophia to a nearby hospital. For this, he was subpoenaed to a federal grand jury, which he refused to participate in. Now, almost 4.5 years later, Steve is being imprisoned for resisting another federal grand jury in Bismarck. For the hour, we hear from Chava with the Tucson Anti-Repression Committee, and James, a lawyer who works with the National Lawyers Guild, about Steve's case, the dangers of grand juries, and why it's imperative for movements to support their incarcerated comrades. More info on the case and ways to support Steve, plus other info on grand juries, can be found at supportstevemartinez.com, and you can also follow the campaign on Twitter via @supportstevenow or Instagram via @supportstevemartinez. And a real quick announcement, good folks in Medford, Oregon are fighting a city ordinance that could land someone in jail for 6 months for sleeping in a tent and 30 days in jail for, quote, organizing or operating an encampment, unquote. There's a petition that's available up at tinyurl.com/Medford petition. And I'm sure if you dig around a little bit, you can find some ways to make noise on the subject. And now some words from anarchist prisoner Sean Swain.
I got my second COVID vaccine shot 2 weeks ago, Moderna. After the first shot, I felt a little lethargic and slept it off for a day. After the second one, just had a sore arm for a while. The needle was about 18 feet long, I think. When the nurse stuck me, the tip of the needle came out in my armpit. But aside from getting impaled, I didn't have any problems. I got COVID twice. First time I had it last February before COVID was even officially here. Medical staff told me I had food poisoning. Food poisoning in my lungs. I guess in a prison setting they chalk up a lot of stuff to food poisoning. I got COVID again this past January. Had to move into what they call a red zone. I called it the zombie apocalypse block. It wasn't so bad. The first time I had COVID, I was stuck in my bed for about 4 days, only got up to puke. Second time, I had a lingering cough for about 2 weeks. I lost my taste and my smell. Each week, all of us in the zombie apocalypse block had to take the swab test. Those are fun. It's like having a Q-tip scraped against your brain. I think I lost portions of my cerebral cortex. Each time I took the swab test, I lost the ability to do simple math for a couple days. I got my sense of smell and taste back. That's not necessarily a good thing. you know, prison food being what it is, and the internal ventilation system constantly recycling stale farts. Here, the vaccinations began in early February. I had to wait until the third wave of vaccinations here because I had just gotten over COVID when the first shots became available. But now they've cycled through. I was one of the last ones here to get my second shot. I know there's a lot of controversy over the vaccines because they were fast-tracked. Probably there are reasonable and legitimate concerns about potential long-term effects that are currently unknowable. But my thinking on that goes like this. A vaccine is a vaccine. There are only so many ways to develop a vaccine. There's a process. And in the course of modern life, our scientists with big, big brains have developed hundreds or thousands or even millions of vaccines for things like polio and smallpox and even the mundane flu that we normally face. We've had these vaccines, some of them, for more than half a century. None of those vaccines have caused widespread sterilization or contained nanobot computer chips or delivered satanic identifiers that work like a barcode for the times of revelations. I have no reason to believe that this vaccine is going to be any different in terms of its long-term health impacts than any of the other vaccines for other diseases. Vaccinated folks have gotten pregnant. Nanobot technology is really expensive and impractical. And if Satan were really that ambitious, Trump would have gotten a second term. There are guys here at the prison, a few, who opted not to get the vaccine. That's a matter of personal choice, I suppose. I question the wisdom of it. Some of those guys tell me that they believe this mass vaccination of prisoners is to do biological testing on us. What that testing is varies according to each prisoner. Some say those in power want to see how the vaccine works or doesn't work on us, getting data on how many of us fall over dead. So far, that number at this prison appears to be zero, by the way, for any secret scientist keeping score at home. Others claim this is an extension of a long history of experimenting on black and brown bodies, going back to the Tuskegee experiments, when government scientists isolated black men and infected them with sexually transmitted diseases, just to see how those diseases progressed. This included infecting those men with syphilis, which caused neurological damage, including dementia, and even death. The U.S. did this, something akin to what the Nazis had done. And, to be fair, this isn't distant past. I did time with a guy named Dan Starks at Mansfield, Ohio, in the 1990s. He had served a sentence in Michigan where he was paid pretty well by prison standards for allowing pharmaceuticals to be tested on him. Last time I saw him, Dan was gaunt and hollow, riddled with cancer, and wondering if years of pharmaceutical tests had been worth it. No doubt we're expendable as prisoners, and the majority of us are black or brown, and there's a long history of dehumanizing experiments on people of color. But even acknowledging that, I have to suspect that if those in power wanted to experiment on us, they just put stuff in our food, or the cleaning chemicals we all use, or pump it through the vents. When someone tells me they don't really know what's in the vaccine, I remind them that they can't identify what they just had for lunch. For all we know, we had a main course of radioactive isotopes with a side order of Zyklon B. If you're going to tell me you don't know what's in the vaccine, explain to me what's in that bag of cheese puffs you're eating. I'm not saying I trust government or large pharmaceutical companies. I just think they have easier and more practical ways of killing us that aren't quite so conspicuous and don't have the extraordinary danger of exposure and widespread blowback. And to the question of why they're vaccinating prisoners so early in the rollout, well, I suspect it's not because they love us so much. It's because they don't want this disease bouncing around in this petri dish prison complex and then spilling back out. And they can get large numbers in a short time, which looks good for the politicians. That's my thinking anyhow. Then I look at the main proponents of the anti-vaxxer movement. Most of them are conservative white men floating in the orbit of the QAnon conspiracy,
believing that a nefarious group of satanic child molesters is carrying out a secret plot to ruin America. When I hear this, I'm convinced that the American public school system is what ruined America by failing to teach these white conservatives how to think. What I'm saying is, it appears that most of the anti-vax theories are originating from folks who have a particular agenda. As a matter of intellectual honesty, I have to dismiss their claims as just a lot of white noise. Anyway, it's 2 weeks since I got my second vaccine shot. My brain's still functioning just as badly as it ever was. No erectile dysfunction, for anyone who wants to know. I haven't felt the urge to shamble or bite anyone. And the blood work from last week shows no significant change in my health status. I feel pretty nanobot free. I don't regret choosing to get vaccinated. This is anarchist prisoner Sean Swain, an exile from Ohio at Buckingham Correctional in Dillon, Virginia. If you're listening, you are the resistance.
You can write to Sean Swain by addressing letters to Sean Swain, number 201-5638, Buckingham Correctional Center, P.O. Box 630, Dillon, Virginia, 23936. He has a book that is available from Little Black Cart Distro. His zines can be found online at theanarchistlibrary.org, and other of his writings and updates are still available at swainrocks.org. Sean has a complaint pending before the Inter-American Human Rights Commission for the torture that he suffered at the hands of the state of Ohio. He is also collecting letters of support for his bid for clemency. You can find more details on Instagram by following Swainiac1969. You can find his past writings, recordings of his audio segments, and updates on his case at seanswain.org, or now follow him on Twitter at @SwainRocks.
Would you please introduce yourselves to the audience with any names, preferred pronouns, affiliations, or other information that pertain to this chat?
My name is Chava, and I work with Tucson Anti-Oppression Committee in Tohono-O'odham Territories, also known as Tucson. And I have done anti-oppression and movement defense work for around 13 years and grand jury support work for the last 4 or 5 years. And I use they and them pronouns.
My name's James. I use he, him pronouns. I'm a lawyer with the National Lawyers Guild based out of Austin, Texas. And I've also been doing anti-repression and activist legal support for about 13 years now, including a number of grand jury support situations.
So would you all please tell us who is Steve Martinez and how did he come to be called before a federal grand jury after a brutal night in November of 2016? And what happened with that grand jury back then?
Steve started out coming to Standing Rock really thinking that he was just going to drop off water. And he actually had been working in the oil fields, the Bakken oil fields in western North Dakota prior to that, heard about what was happening at Standing Rock and was really inspired by what he had seen and heard about happening, even though he was also working for the oil fields and the oil company. He's indigenous from Pueblo community in northern New Mexico and also Chicano, and grew up in southern Colorado. And just inspired by the indigenous land resistance and movement happening. And so he loaded up his vehicle with water to come and take it to the camps. And then he never left. And he became really involved in what was going on there from the point of the summer all the way up to that night that you mentioned in November, which a lot of people remember that there were like fire hoses used in, you know, sub-freezing temperatures by law enforcement on water protectors that night in a conflict that lasted, you know, 12 to 14 hours on the bridge in those cold temperatures. And a young woman named Sophia Wilansky was really gravely injured that night, presumably due to law enforcement's use of so-called less lethal munitions. She nearly lost her arm. When she was injured, getting emergency services was almost impossible to get for emergency vehicles and services to get to that point on this highway that had been blockaded by law enforcement at that point for around a month or more. And in order for her to get to emergency services, she would have to be driven by someone who was on the other side of that blockade. And that person who volunteered to do that was Steve, who was acting as a good Samaritan, doing the right thing in that moment. And then just really a handful of days later was subpoenaed before a grand jury, and his presence was requested to provide information. They said they were asking for information related to Sophia Wolanski's injuries. So any testimony he could provide or any images he might have taken on a cell phone or anything like that. And Steve didn't know what that subpoena was when he received it. And so he reached out to a relative that stayed in the same camp that I did at the time. And I had gone up there to do legal support for people. And his relative then came to me and said, "Hey, can you speak with my uncle? He's received some kind of subpoena. We don't really know what it is." And at that time, then just pulled his uncle into a tent. And that uncle turned out to be Steve. And immediately from that moment that he received that paperwork, he asked for support and then happened to have one of the best, most knowledgeable movement attorneys on grand juries in camp that day, which is Lauren Regan from the Civil Liberties Defense Center. You know, maybe it's just pure luck. Maybe it's, you know, serendipitous or that Lauren happened to be there that day, but we were able to immediately get Steve talking with an attorney who could explain to him the process. And then also from that exact day moving forward, it also began a massive outreach with the thousands of people who were staying in camp at that point about grand jury occurring, subpoenas going out, at least one known subpoena at that point. And then also initiated a nationwide education campaign because many tens of thousands of people had come and gone from the camps. And so that is where Steve was 4 years ago. But almost exactly 4 years later, he was subpoenaed to this new grand jury. And he again has refused to comply because he's acting in immense solidarity with a movement that he believes in, which is a movement for indigenous sovereignty over lands and waters and to protect those things, and a deep love and care for his comrades. And so that's where we are now and how we got there.
Do people feel like they have an understanding of what this grand jury is specifically about? And does that matter?
We're quite confident that it's about the situation regarding Sophia Wolanski. One sort of important development between Steve's grand jury subpoena in 2016 and when he got subpoenaed again in 2020 was that Ms. Wolanski has sued Morton County over their use of, you know, these less lethal munitions that caused her injury. And in, I can't remember if it was October or November of 2020, the judge in that civil lawsuit made a ruling that she could seek to compel the government to disclose evidence, specifically the fragments that were taken from her arm during surgery. And it was just a matter of days after that court's ruling in the civil lawsuit that Steve was again subpoenaed to this grand jury. So it's kind of, you know, the timing is convenient, as they say.
Yeah, I think you spoke well to that, James. The timing is suspect. And I think it's also interesting to note that throughout the whole course of legal battles related to Standing Rock, both criminal and civil legal battles, there has been some signs of real collusion between civil court and criminal court. There's been a number of attempts at slap suits and civil suits by ETP Energy Transfer Partners that continue even now. And this timing of, you know, this win in Sophia's case with that judge to compel the government to turn over this evidence, which I'll just note, you know, there were FBI agents lurking outside of her surgery room, outside of the OR, waiting to confiscate those items while her family is like crying in a hallway, you know. And that, I just think it's important to remember the cruelty of the state in this, the course of this entire situation, because I don't think that's most people's experience when they're in a really scary, dangerous situation that involves possibly losing a limb or use of that limb. And so the way that it looks like the government has been able to make sure Sophia's attorneys cannot get that evidence back from the federal government is by saying it's part of an ongoing investigation. And so if there's a new grand jury looking into these facts from who knows what, 4 years ago, then they can't turn that evidence over to the civil court because there's this ongoing criminal investigation. So it seems pretty well timed and convenient on their part, and really just a continued leverage of cruelty against Sophia and against other water protectors who were injured and harmed at the hands of law enforcement. And also unbelievable amount of cruelty leveraged against Steve, who all he did on that night was the right thing. And now 4 years later, he's dragged back before a grand jury in what seems like just using him as if he's a pawn, but he's a real person with a family and a life. And now he's separated from them while he's incarcerated.
I think the other key portion of this story and the cruelty that Hava is talking about is how Martin County has tried to basically twist the narrative. While all the evidence that, you know, we know about points to Martin County law enforcement being responsible for Sophia's injuries and for the use of these less lethal munitions, they've always tried to either directly say or insinuate that this was actually caused by other water protectors or potentially even by Sophia herself. And so the sort of victim blaming narrative that they've tried to use to tar the movement, kind of like what, you know, what the government did with environmentalist Judy Berry, you know, when her car got bombed and they tried to blame her for that. And so it's kind of a continuation of that, that bad actors will inflict horrible violence on activists and then try and twist the narrative to blame the activists for that violence that they're inflicted.
This is The Final Straw, and you're hearing Hava from Tucson Anti-Repression Committee and James from the National Lawyers Guild talk about the grand jury resistance and repression of Steve Martinez. More at supportstevemartinez.com.
So this is the beginning of a long conversation, but can you tell us a little bit about grand juries? They're a pretty complicated legal tool that is shrouded in mystery. And just to kind of remind us about what they are, how they operate, and sort of their range in uses from the mundane to political repression.
Yeah, absolutely. Most of the uses of a grand jury are pretty mundane. You know, speaking here specifically about federal grand juries, because it can vary a lot from state to state whether there are grand juries or how they work. But in the federal system, pretty much every felony case goes before a grand jury. And the purpose of the grand jury is to decide whether or not the government has enough evidence to even bring charges against somebody. It's supposed to be a sort of screening or gatekeeping kind of function to make sure that people aren't brought to trial on serious charges without, you know, at least some amount of evidence. That's sort of the ideological idea behind their use. In practicality, it tends to be much more of a rubber stamp. There's a famous quote from a judge in New York that a grand jury would indict a ham sandwich if that's what a prosecutor wanted, because the prosecutor controls the entire process. And so in most grand jury proceedings, what happens is that a federal law enforcement, federal agent of some type will go to the grand jury, maybe summarize a police report, give some facts, some details, and the grand jurors will decide if that's enough evidence to constitute probable cause to bring charges against somebody. And it, you know, typically pretty quick proceeding. You know, the cop says, oh, we did this raid and we found these drugs and these people were there and we know that this was their apartment. And so in that way, a lot of the grand jury use is, you know, kind of unexceptional, even if it is still problematic in regards to how much power and control it gives to the prosecutors in this system. In a more political context, what we see, though, is actually using the grand jury as an investigative tool, as a way to compel witnesses to appear and give testimony, or compel people to turn over evidence of some type. And this is where we see, you know, analogies to grand juries as like a fishing expedition or a witch hunt or something, where people are sort of dragged before these legal proceedings and forced to, you know, name names or give evidence or something of that sort. And so the way the grand jury works is that there's typically, I believe, 24 jurors. So it's twice as big as what you think of as a typical jury in a trial. There's 24 jurors. And the only people in the grand jury room at the time are the grand jurors themselves, the United States attorney, the prosecutor, the court reporter, maybe some clerical staff, and the witness who's giving evidence. There's no defense attorneys, there's no judges, there's no audience. It all happens very much in secrecy. And the other aspect is that, you know, sometimes we think about, you know, in a jury trial, you have the lone holdout juror that prevents somebody from getting convicted. In a grand jury proceeding, they only have to decide by a simple majority. So you can't have a single lone holdout grand juror, because as long as, you know, 13 people still vote to charge somebody or to indict somebody, the other 11 people, their votes don't really matter. Grand jurors, again, in opposition to what we normally think of in terms of a jury, grand jurors are not screened for bias. There were situations during grand juries that were investigating alleged acts of animal liberation, earth liberation groups, where people that basically worked in the industries that were being targeted by these animal and earth liberation groups, other people in those industries were actually sitting on the grand juries that were reviewing the cases that were, you know, allegedly targeting those industries. So there's no screening for bias. It's, you know, supposed to be a cross-section of the community, but it's kind of random. And there is a long history of discrimination and who gets selected to sit on a grand jury, who gets selected as the foreperson of a grand jury. And so, you know, what turns into is this, you know, secretive proceeding with almost no oversight or accountability, where the prosecutor has total control over what evidence they present. They don't have to present contradictory evidence. They don't have to present exculpatory evidence. They don't have to present anything that would be unfavorable to the outcome that they seek. They can present the evidence in whatever light they want. And they can also present evidence that, you know, is illegally gathered or that wouldn't be admissible in a normal trial. So things like hearsay, rumor, gossip, evidence that was collected as from a, you know, illegal search or seizure, statements that were maybe coerced or compelled in a way that wasn't constitutional. All this evidence can be presented at a grand jury in furtherance of what the prosecutor wants to see happen. And so, you know, considering the scope of this, another thing that we see in some of these political cases is, you know, people getting called to grand juries to testify about things that are, you know, sort of far afield of what they directly experienced. There's one case where somebody was being asked to testify about something that he allegedly overheard two other people saying at a bar or a coffee shop, not something that he was, you know, directly involved in or directly participating in, but sort of this third or fourth hand rumor that he had overheard.
As you mentioned, James, the witness that's being called before the grand jury is seated before grand jurors, the prosecutors, stenographers, you know, court officials, doesn't have a lawyer present, right? And a lawyer could hypothetically, if they had a role there, challenge some of those things that might be inadmissible in a normal court setting. But they also can't really warn someone about safe approaches towards answering the questions or not answering the questions. Are there safe approaches?
So, I mean, this is getting into you know, sort of the difference between political advice and legal advice. I'm not obviously not here to give anybody legal advice. And if anybody's ever called before a grand jury, they really need to have a good lawyer that shares their values and their goals to represent them and, you know, inform them of all the, you know, nuances and implications here. Politically, I would argue that there is no safe way to answer questions at a grand jury. And this is for a variety of reasons. I think one reason is that you don't know what they're looking for. People have an idea that, like, you know, I didn't do anything wrong or I don't have anything to hide. And I think that's generally mistaken. I think, you know, part of it is the broad expanse of federal law, that things that you wouldn't even imagine are illegal and felonious under federal law. So you don't know, you know, what's going to incriminate you or incriminate somebody else. You also don't know, you know, what somebody else, you know, might be exposed to. You know, maybe you have a reasonably good idea of what actions you've taken and what things might put you at risk, but you don't know what your best friend or your family member or your comrade or your, you know, neighbor or your fellow organizer, you know, what they might be subject to. And so things that might seem supposedly innocuous or harmless can easily cause significant problems for people. The other thing that we see is, you know, we have this idea of, like, back in the Red Scare, McCarthyism, people getting dragged before hearings and being forced to name names. And then everybody, you know, everybody that they name then also gets dragged before the hearing, and kind of this dragnet approach to investigations. And, you know, that's entirely possible with grand juries too, that, you know, the mere fact of you identifying somebody else, you know, even if it's not in a way that criminally incriminates them, could be grounds for them to get dragged in front of this grand jury also. And then they're faced with this sort of impossible situation where they have to either decide to testify or face imprisonment for contempt. And I think, you know, again, speaking politically, I think the idea of solidarity and building, you know, trust and cohesion in our movements is really fractured when somebody that's involved in those movements goes before a secret grand jury and gives testimony that there's no accountability or transparency for. It's often hard for people to trust one another in that situation. So that's how, you know, grand juries can serve to sort of sow this distrust and paranoia and discord within movements and really, really fracture the solidarity that's necessary for effective organizing.
First, you said in the beginning of your question, you know, like, is there any safe way to answer questions before the grand jury? And James, you spoke really well about all of the reasons they're not. That question you asked, Bruce, is sort of a gateway into strategy that we've seen be effective in recent years for resisting a grand jury. There's essentially four ways somebody can resist a grand jury. You can avoid being subpoenaed, which means you need to know that there's a grand jury happening, and that's actually a lot harder to avoid a subpoena than it sounds. But a subpoena for a grand jury does have to be served to you in person by a federal agent, by a federal law enforcement agent. It doesn't have to be an FBI agent. It could be an ATF agent or a BIA officer or whatever. But you would have to avoid that person and know that they were coming for you. You could also receive a subpoena and you could just disappear. And some people have used that strategy to varied success, but it's very difficult because it means you have to basically go on the run. You're avoiding complying with that subpoena. And it means that you would have to leave the place where you normally live, stop talking to people you normally speak to. And that's a really difficult way for somebody to exist. The other thing is that you could receive a subpoena and you could publicly refuse to enter the courtroom. And some people have done that very successfully, because even entering the courtroom, like James said, we don't know for sure what's happened in there. right? So all of your comrades and the larger movement on the outside of this secretive process, we don't know what's going on in there. So you run a risk when you enter the courtroom that potentially could leave some room for mistrust amongst the movement. But we have also seen this last option where you receive the subpoena, you publicly refuse to cooperate, but you enter the courtroom and then you invoke your constitutional rights that apply in the situation in your refusal to testify, which is the tactic that Steve has used and other recent grand jury resistors have used successfully, is that it sets up a great legal precedent for getting you out of the legal consequence that occurs when you refuse to comply with the grand jury, which is if you refuse to comply, you could be held in civil contempt for up to the length of the grand jury. And that could be 18 months. And that's a long time. But we've seen the use of this legal maneuver called a Grumbles motion, which basically appeals to the judge who's holding you in contempt, a civil contempt of court, for your refusal to testify, and says, this person has stated publicly that they're never going to comply. They're never going to testify. They have continued to not comply or testify. And you holding them in jail or prison during this grand jury for their refusal to testify has gone from this civil form of contempt to something that's now illegal, because you're actually holding them in jail knowing that that's not going to be the coercive tool that you hope it will be to get them to comply and to testify before the grand jury. And it's not legal to hold someone in prison in that way because they've never committed a crime, and you've then the state, the government has crossed the line, right? They've crossed their own legal line. And that's a strategy that's worked well, but it does require that somebody, you know, sets up the infrastructure along with their comrades in the larger movement to support them. And that means being very, very public from the beginning of your situation, which is what happened with Steve the first time that he was subpoenaed to a grand jury, and what has happened with him the second time that he's been subpoenaed.
TFSR is a proud member of the Channel Zero Network of Anarchist Podcasts, and here's a jingle from another member of CZN.
Hey, everybody. My name's Eamon, and I'm the host of a show on the Channel Zero Network called Radical People. And wouldn't you know it, we're going into the third season. It's a monthly show, so it's really not hard to get extra seasons. But anyway, basically, it's a show in which I interview people who are involved in direct action or direct action campaigns, past or present, and we hear their great stories. Anyway, it's on the Channel Zero Network, it's on iTunes, and I'm sure at this point you know how to find a podcast. Radical People. Check it out.
This is The Final Straw, and you're hearing Hava from Tucson Anti-Repression Committee and James from the National Lawyers Guild talk about the grand jury resistance and repression of Steve Martinez. More at supportstevemartinez.com.
So just to belabor the point, because nobody actually said this, I don't think, when you both have mentioned going into the grand jury and then refusing to speak and getting held in contempt, what happens if somebody invokes their Fifth Amendment? And why does that make it so this sort of proceeding so scary?
So when somebody goes in and they're asked a question by the prosecutor is going to say something like, hey, what's your name? State it for the record. So I would say, my name is Hava so-and-so. And then the prosecutor would ask me, okay, tell me about what James had for lunch yesterday. And I would say, you know what? I'm going to actually invoke my first, my fourth, my fifth, and any other applicable amendment rights that I might have. The prosecutor is going to be like, oh, great. Okay, well, what did James have for lunch day before yesterday? I'd say, I'm going to invoke my first, my fourth, my fifth, and any other applicable amendment rights. And then eventually the prosecutor is going to be very clear that that's my entire plan while I'm present in their grand jury room. And then they're going to take me before a judge because they're going to ask for me to be held in contempt. And then they're likely to request from a judge that I be given immunity. And that immunity means that anything I say can't necessarily be used against me. right? And that's what the Fifth Amendment provides to us, is like protection from testifying things that would incriminate ourselves. But what we don't know is how our words then can be used against someone else, or how someone else's words could be used against us. So it doesn't protect us entirely. It just protects us in this very narrow way. And the court and the government call it being granted immunity. Like there's some fucking fairy godmother that's coming and waving a wand and giving us this great gift. But it's not a great gift. They're actually imposing and forcing something on us that strips us of our rights in that courtroom, our very limited rights, and takes them away from us, because that's the like beauty of the rights that the state has given us, right? They can give and they can take, and that's all at their discretion. So they impose immunity on you, and you no longer, when you are taken in before the grand jury, can refuse to answer questions based off of your Fifth Amendment rights, right? And so then at that point, you would be taken, when you continue to refuse, taken back before a judge, who then would likely decide, okay, well, we're going to put you into coercive incarceration. So we're going to try and compel this testimony out of you by incarcerating you. And then things move from there. And that's where we are right now with Steve, is at that point. Immunity has been imposed upon him. He's being held in contempt. And his contempt will be reviewed on a monthly basis by the judge in North Dakota.
So y'all have mentioned that Steve went before the grand jury in 2016. Steve was again called this year, I believe, before a grand jury, and then released. Is that correct? Like, where does Steve stand at the moment?
Right. So when Steve was subpoenaed in 2016, his appearance date was actually in early 2017, and he went and refused to testify. And the prosecutor never pursued contempt proceedings against him. They ended up withdrawing the subpoena before he had to be found in contempt or be incarcerated or anything. When he first appeared in February, just about a month and a half ago, he again refused to cooperate and very quickly was taken before a federal magistrate judge, found in contempt and ordered into coercive custody for contempt. His legal team filed some motions and objections on the grounds that the magistrate judge actually did not have legal authority to find Steve in contempt or order him into custody. There's some, you know, complicated nuanced laws around that. But basically, he was ordered into jail by a judge that didn't have authority to order him into jail. And so his legal team filed some motions and objections, and they were granted, and he was released from jail after 19 days of being unlawfully incarcerated. But before they released him from jail, they subpoenaed him again to the same grand jury to appear on March 3rd. And when he appeared on March 3rd and again refused to cooperate, this time they brought him in front of a federal district judge who did have authority to conduct contempt proceedings. And so at that point, he was again found in contempt and ordered back into custody. So I think this is a pretty salient example of, you know, just how ripe for abuse grand jury proceedings can be, that they can illegally incarcerate you for, you know, almost 3 weeks. And then the remedy for that is that you get released, but then you just get re-subpoenaed and taken back and the whole thing starts again. And so, you know, the prosecution really gets, in some ways, they get unlimited bites at the apple. That, you know, if I think we mentioned earlier that he can be incarcerated up to the length that this grand jury is impaneled, which is, you know, typically 18 months, but can be longer in some circumstances. But if that grand jury expires, there's nothing that prevents the prosecutor from subpoenaing him to a subsequent grand jury. And in this way, you know, we've seen, you know, throughout history that grand juries, there's not a whole lot of check on this. And so it can really be used to harass and incapacitate activists and you know, entire movement communities.
So, Hava, earlier you had brought up the idea of slap suits. Could you define that for the audience? And also maybe, I don't want to take this too far off of a focus on Steve, but I'd like to recontextualize this again to be within not only supporting someone who has proven himself to be brave and an amazing supporter of other people involved in movement, but besides Morton County law enforcement trying to avoid, or state officials trying to avoid, possible lawsuits for the damages that they've caused to people, how does it relate to the timing right now of the operation of DAPL?
Well, speak to slap suits and what they are. SLAP is an acronym for Strategic Lawsuit Against Public Participation. And it basically refers to lawsuits that typically it's large entities like corporations, sometimes governments, you know, powerful people filing against activists or journalists or sort of the little guy for the purpose of basically retaliating against or silencing their damaging statements. And a lot of times this takes the form of defamation lawsuits, libel or slander. And so maybe corporation sues this small activist group and says that, you know, these statements about us clubbing baby seals are defamatory and they have to stop saying it and pay us damages. And, you know, a lot of the purpose of these lawsuits isn't necessarily to win the lawsuit. Because of the power disparity, it's often intended just to tie up the organization or the people in litigation. That if you're a big corporation with, you know, billions in revenue and expenditures every year, it's no big deal for you to spend $1 million on, you know, a lawsuit. But if you're a, you know, small, scrappy activist group or a citizen journalist or, you know, something, or a whistleblower or something, you know, defending this, you know, humongous lawsuit can be, you know, totally debilitating. And so there are statutes in a number of states that allow procedures to quickly dismiss these types of lawsuits. And that's, I mean, kind of a whole other conversation, but I would, you know, if people are interested in this topic, the Civil Liberties Defense Center website has a number of resources about slap suits and defending against slap suits and things of that nature. I can't speak to the situation with DAPL specifically, maybe Hava can, but I will say that, you know, we're kind of in this moment where a lot of pipeline resistance efforts have seen some success recently. There was the pipeline that was supposed to run through Appalachia that got canceled. Resistance against Line 3 in Minnesota has really been taking off. And so I think there is this sort of moment where, you know, people that are invested in these pipeline projects are seeing the success that resistance movements are having and are looking for new ways to subvert those movements, undermine those movements, and push back against those movements. And so I think, you know, it's impossible to say, like, if there's a direct correlation between, you know, that and what's going on with Steve's case. But I do think it is sort of a reminder of what tools the state has against some of these movements and how those movements should sort of think about making anti-repression and legal support and movement defense an integral part of their organizing throughout their campaigns.
I think one of the strategies that Energy Transfer Partners, which is like the larger company that was pursuing the Dakota Access Pipeline, along with many other pipeline-related projects across North America. But Energy Transfer Partners' goal with slap suits is not even necessarily to win. It's a way of industry leveraging the law, in particular laws around RICO, which a lot of people have heard at least that term related to like organized crime type cases, but leveraging those laws as a way for industry to have a chilling effect on movements that are successful against them. And so Energy Transfer Partners kind of famously filed this outrageous slap suit, including Greenpeace as one of the named parties that they were suing, and asking for like almost $1 billion, I think, in damages, which they knew they were never going to win that award of money in civil court. That wasn't the point. The point was to make movements and NGOs or nonprofit organizations that were supporting social movements against ETP's various pipeline projects, to make them have to scramble and exhaust their resources, both financially and as far as like people power, real like human labor, to exhaust them to a point where you're so focused on fighting the slap suit that you can't be focused anymore on fighting the people who are suing you. And that was dismissed in court because it was outrageous, right? But it doesn't mean that it didn't have some of its intended impact, which was to distract people's energies towards this other thing. And ETP continues to do this. But we also know that pipelines are failing as like financial projects. And it was known that the Dakota Access Pipeline was only ever going to be financially beneficial in the short term. It's basically like a big scam to make a bunch of money at the beginning, and that it was going to be a financial failure in the long run. But their goal isn't to make better energy for anybody. If they were, they would be pursuing other things. Their goal is to make money, and at any cost possible.
All right.
Directions on how to use your radio. Find the power button. Turn it to on. Turn the knob to CKUT 90.3 FM. Relax and enjoy.
You are just listening to a March podcast from The Final Straw Radio. You can find this full March 12th episode at thefinalstrawradio.libsyn.com. And some news you can use. This Saturday, Montrealers will march to honor Rebecca Harry. Harry's recent death in LaSalle made her the seventh Quebec woman to die from domestic violence in 7 weeks. Deputy Premier Genevieve Guilbeault said Monday that she will head a new provincial committee on violence against women. The vigil for Harry is at 5:30 tomorrow at Cabot Square. And Montreal youth group Project 10 is holding a weekly online ballroom workshop starting in April. Programmers say they want to foster community and expression among Two-Spirit, queer, trans, black, indigenous, and people of color. The free workshops are Thursdays at 6 p.m. through Zoom and are open to people ages 14 to 25. Go to P10 Montreal on Instagram to learn more. And in lighter news, Cafe Resonance is streaming every Saturday night to feature local musicians. The virtual show runs 8 p.m. at twitch.tv/florafonerecords. That's F-L-O-R-A-F-O-N-E records. And in holidays, Wednesday was the International Day of Trans Visibility, and this coming Sunday will be Easter. That concludes this Friday's edition of Off the Hour, produced by Montreal's Community News Collective. I'm your host, Brian Jefferson, and this show was made by Alice Wu, Sarah Jesmer, and Kate Addison.
And you're listening to Montreal-based artist Wayne Tennant. You're listening to his Freedom track.
Have any questions about something you heard in the last hour? Do you want to make news produced by and for the Montreal community? Reach out to CKUT's Community News Department at 514-448-4041 extension 6788, or send us an email at newsintern@ckut.ca, or connect with us on Facebook, just search CKUT. Stay tuned to 90.3 FM for Cafe coming up next.
The alert level in your region or a neighboring region is red. To curb the spread of COVID-19, gatherings with family and friends in private homes and yards are prohibited. Travel between regions should be avoided. It is forbidden to leave your home between 9:30 p.m. and 5 a.m. Visit quebec.ca/coronavirus to learn more about other measures in place to fight COVID-19. Follow all the rules, all the time, no exceptions. A message from the Gouvernement du Québec.
The global outbreak of COVID-19 has affected all our lives in various ways, and it has notably drawn our attention to the intensified systemic racism and selective xenophobia towards our racialized friends in our Canadian society. It is understandable for each of us to feel anxious about this fatal disease. However, the sentiment of fear does not give us the right or the opportunity to conduct hate crime and to discriminate against our Asians, Blacks, Indigenous, and other racialized friends. It is not okay to associate the COVID-19 disease with Asians, particularly those of Chinese descent. It is not okay to conduct physical and psychological abuses towards racialized individuals.